You've heard of deficit hawks. They suggest we temper the deficit with spending cuts and revenue increases. Then there's deficit doves, who want to put off austerity measures until the economy has recovered. Now, there's a new breed of bird, deficit owls. They don't actually think we need to balance the budget at all. Today on Central Standard, Modern Monetary Theory. It's a new approach to budget deficits being developed in our own owl-filled backyard, a.k.a. the UMKC Economics Department. The economists here at UMKC have concluded that everyone, members of Congress, and the entire mainstream of the economics profession has misunderstood how the government interacts with the economy. If they're right, then everything we thought we knew about budget, taxes, and the Federal Reserve is wrong. We examine that ahead on Central Standard following this hour's news. Good morning, Kansas City. It's safe to say that approaches to fiscal and economic policy have gone to the birds. There are deficit hawks who advocate sharp government spending cuts, and deficit doves who want to hold off austerity measures and wait for the economy to adjust. And then there are the owls. We're about to meet the deficit owls. This is Central Standard. I'm Jabalani LaFall. Joining us now is Stephanie Kelton, who coined the phrase deficit owl and who is an econ professor at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. We also have William Black, a professor of law and economics, also at UMKC. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Professor Kelton, let's start with the first question. What is a deficit owl? You got hawks and doves, deficit owls.
A deficit owl is someone who understands that you can't just look at what's happening to the government's budget in isolation, that you have to understand that the economy is multi-sectoral, the government is just one sector in the economy, and that before you can say anything really sensible about whether the government's budget balance is appropriate, you need to understand what the implications of the government's balance are for the other sectors in the economy.
How did you come up with that term?
Well, because you have to be something different from what's already out there when you understand that neither the hawks nor the doves understand, I think, what's really at issue here. And you need somebody wiser and who can take the emotional charge out of the issue and just examine it kind of for what it is, you know?
So I guess you guys got together and said, who can be reasonable, essentially? How has the philosophy of the deficit owl evolved?
I don't know that it's evolved. We've been building on the same sorts of arguments for a long period of time now. And the work really doesn't originate with us at all. It dates way back. One of the people who's influenced us most is an economist by the name of Abba Lerner. And Lerner understood very well in the early 1940s exactly the same kinds of arguments that we're making today with respect to the government's budget and fiscal policy and so forth.
But you and Professor Black and another colleague have developed this concept of modern monetary theory, the phrase your colleagues tend to advocate these days. William Black, what are its main tenets? And Professor Kelton, you can feel free to jump in at any time. What are the main tenets of modern monetary policy, or MMT?
Well, first, I'm definitely not a developer of MMT. I'm a criminologist who had the primary appointment in economics. But certainly the things that people emphasize about modern monetary theory is, first, it's mostly a description. This is how the monetary system actually operates. And if you understand how the monetary system actually operates, a whole bunch of the arguments that people make in this dove versus hawk debate don't make any sense, period. So you avoid that thicket of things that are just plain wrong. That also means, by the way, that we have tremendous support among practitioners. So people who actually invest money and know the monetary system tend to be quite supportive of this approach. One of the things that MMT folks have done is look at history. And so the United States history shows that we have overwhelmingly operated under federal budget deficits during our greatest growth periods. And that in the periods, and there are only a few, there are about eight, in which we've had very sharp reductions in deficits, they've always been followed by either a depression or, this time, a great recession. So that gives us great caution as to the claim that you should be running a budget surplus. There's something good inherently about running a budget surplus. If you understand the monetary system, you also realize that the central metaphor that people use who don't understand the system is wrong. And the central metaphor is the household. Well, whatever makes sense for me must be the same for a government with a sovereign currency. And that proves not to be true on many dimensions.
And that's one of the central tenets of MMT. Both of your arguments are that budget surplus is seen by many in political circles as a good term to throw around is actually misunderstood at best and bad at worst.
Well, one of the other things that MMT economists do that most economists don't do is we pay attention to accounting, and we really incorporate that into our entire framework. And so we understand that logically and by definition, the government's surplus is equal to the penny, the non-government's deficit. And so if you've got the government running surpluses, it means the non-government sector must be running deficits. And the reverse, of course, is also true, that when the government is running a deficit, the non-government sector, where you and I reside, are in surplus.
And so are you, in effect, saying that a government deficit is a good thing?
Well, I'm saying that it can be. And again, we're in a multi-sectoral economy. And so in addition to the private domestic sector, which includes the households and the firms in the economy that you're looking at, so let's say the U.S., U.S. households and U.S. businesses, that's part of the private sector. Then you have the government sector, and then you have the rest of the world. If we were a country that ran huge trade surpluses, then we could, in a sense, afford to run budget surpluses. The government could run surpluses, and the private sector would still be all right. It could be in surplus. So you've got to pay attention to what's going on with the other sectors in the economy. We in the U.S., of course, run big trade deficits, and those trade deficits have a negative impact on the domestic private sector that can only be offset by deficit spending by the government.
So a budget surplus isn't good if you have a trade deficit.
Exactly.
And so what is the essential argument here? What is the use of a government deficit? How is it used to affect good economic policy?
Well, ideally, it would be used like a shock absorber. Ideally, you would allow the government's budget to expand and contract as necessary in order to insulate the private sector from those inevitable ups and downs in the economy. So, you know, capitalist economies, market economies cycle. All of them do. They have boom periods and bust periods. And in a downturn, the government's budget expands, partly because of automatic stabilizers, unemployment compensation, taxes fall off, other forms of government transfer payments go up, the deficit goes up. In addition to the stuff that happens automatically, the government can do more in terms of discretionary policy, spending on projects that make good sense, that are good for public purpose, increase spending, allow the deficit to increase, and that, of course, ends up increasing the private sector surplus. It helps the private sector rebuild its balance sheets, gain income. Income creates sales. Sales create jobs.
We're running a really good real-world test of the difference in systems between the United States and Europe. Europe has decided that it's going to have, in the midst of trying to recover from a terrible recession, aptly named the Great Recession, that it wants budgetary surpluses. And that effort to do so has pushed the entire Eurozone back into recession, first. And the second, now this is a sophisticated thing that I actually learned from listening to Professor Kelton. You can't simply decide to run a budgetary surplus when you're in a recession. You can try to, right? You can raise taxes or you can cut spending to try to run a surplus. But that, since there's already inadequate private sector demand, means that private sector demand becomes even more inadequate with a tax increase, or public sector demand becomes even more inadequate with a spending decrease. And the combination can thrust you deeper into recession where your tax revenues fall and you don't end up in surplus. In fact, your deficit can end up larger. So you can't simply choose to run a surplus when you're in a deep recession. And trying to do so can be the worst possible strategy.
You're listening to Central Standard on 89.3 FM. The call letters are KCUR. We're streaming live on KCUR.org. I'm Jabalani LaFall. Stephanie Kelton, who coined the phrase deficit owl, is an econ professor at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, and one of our guests today. We also have William Black, also a professor of economics and law, also at UMKC. Both are regaling us on their schools of thought around modern monetary theory. And it's interesting, Professor Black, that you just mentioned Europe, because both of you were recently at an MMT summit in Rimini, Italy. And tell us about why you were there and what you presented. What happened over there?
Well, we were there because a man by the name of Paolo Barnard took an interest in MMT, discovered our work, discovered our blog, which we, Bill and I, both contribute to, along with another colleague of ours named Randy Ray from the Department of Economics. And we started this blog about 2.5 years ago. It's called New Economic Perspectives. And a lot of people have discovered the blog. It's a top 20 ranked blog now. And so somebody over there who's a journalist discovered MMT and started corresponding with us a couple of years ago. And he decided that, you know, in light of everything that's taking place in Europe right now, it would make sense to try to do something big. And so he put out a call to his following, and he said, how about we have this event over here? We'll talk about economics. We'll talk about the future of Europe, and we'll talk about what, in particular, Italy can do to extract itself from the problems that it faces by virtue of adopting the euro. And so let's invite these guys and see if they'll come out and do this. So he sent an email. We said we'd be delighted. The next thing we knew, he said he had over 1,400 subscriptions come in. He was asking people to contribute 40 euro a piece to listen to us for 2.5 days, talk economics. And all of a sudden, the thing blew up, and he couldn't find a venue large enough. And the next thing we knew, we were getting an email telling us that we would be doing the event in a basketball arena in Rimini, because it was the only place that was large enough to hold the expected turnout. So,
interestingly enough, the stage is set in Rimini, Italy, not too far from the scene of that large cruise ship sinking. And then you have this sort of interesting metaphorical atmosphere and this interesting rock star atmosphere over there for people really interested in your economic theories, complete with T-shirts. Tell us about the T-shirt. We have a picture of that T-shirt up on the Central Standard Facebook page now. It has the euro and handcuffs, and under it, it says modern monetary theory. Tell us about that T-shirt, what it means.
Well, first, it's a fabulous T-shirt, and it was designed by a taxi driver's girlfriend and the taxi driver, and modern entrepreneurial stuff lets you get these things put on the web, and we've actually helped a little bit with that effort. Because nations that are part of the euro no longer have a sovereign currency, they cannot implement any of the three things you typically do to try to get out of a severe recession. Those three things, and they're not mutually exclusive, you can do all of them at the same time, are you can have an aggressive monetary policy. That means your money supply grows a lot. You can have an aggressive fiscal policy. That means you run a bigger deficit. Or you can devalue your currency. Well, you can't have an aggressive monetary policy because Germany controls the European Central Bank, the ECB, and it is scared to death of inflation, so it doesn't allow aggressive monetary policy. You can't have an aggressive fiscal policy because the oxymoron that's called the Stability and Growth Pact, which actually produces instability and negative growth, doesn't permit you, even in a severe recession, to have an effective automatic stabilizer of the kind Professor Kelton was just described. And of course, you don't have your own currency, so you can't devalue your currency. And that's why it serves the euro like a handcuff. It takes away all of your policy space. And Professor Kelton presented graphs that showed just how tiny that policy space becomes for nations once they get in trouble. And there's another element we haven't added, and that is because you don't have your own currency, your debts are in definitionally in what is in essence a foreign currency, the euro, and you are subject to the bond market vigilantes, and they can create a destructive cycle in which it gets ever worse.
So what I'm hearing, Professor Kelton, is that monetary policy at the seat of power in Brussels is out of alignment with the individual fiscal policies of European nations such as the PIGS nations, Portugal, Ireland, Greece, Spain, et cetera. Is that in the ballpark?
Oh, it's definitely in the ballpark. It's a home run. What they did was decide to give up their currencies and hand over monetary policy to a single authority, the European Central Bank, but retain their own fiscal policy at the national level, but with restrictions like Bill was just explaining, the Stability and Growth Pact, which lays out rules that say you're not allowed to run a deficit that exceeds 3% of your GDP. Well, everybody's blown through that. I mean, virtually all 17 countries, and Germany was the first. Germany and France were the first to blow through that. That was years ago. But this is because when the economy completely tanks, there's nothing you can do. Your tax revenues fall off a cliff, and all kinds of forms of automatic stabilizers increase. So government spending goes up, and your budget deficit blows up automatically. And the Stability and Growth Pact treats the deficit as if it's something that is directly under the control of the government, that they can always keep it under 3%. They can't. And when it blows up and it goes to 7%, 10%, 14% of GDP, bond markets begin to go, uh-oh, wait a minute, your deficits are huge. We're financing these. You guys don't create your own currency. If we're going to continue to lend to you, we want higher and higher and higher premiums. We want higher interest rates. And that's why this whole thing spiraled out of control.
And that's what we're seeing in Greece right now in particular.
Exactly.
You get into a death spiral with the credit rating agencies. As your interest rate goes up, your deficit goes up. So they lower your bond rating, which increases your interest rate, which increases your deficit, which causes them to lower the bond rating and such. And so the only strategy left, and this is why in large part they wanted us in Italy, is to go after TINA. There is no alternative, because that's what Germany is selling. There is no alternative. The only thing you can do is emulate our strategy, which means everybody is supposed to become a net exporter. Now, my export's your import, so this can't work, right? Mathematically, this cannot work. But that is the strategy. And so your mission, if you're Ireland, is to slash working class wages so that you can outcompete the Portuguese. But the Portuguese are slashing their wages so they can outcompete the Italians, who are slashing their wages to outcompete the Greeks, who are slashing their wages to outcompete the Turks. We call this the road to Bangladesh strategy.
And what do you mean by that, the road to Bangladesh?
Because the only folks place you, quote unquote, win this race to the bottom is to reach the absolute bottom in wages, which is approximately Bangladesh. I mean, you can actually pick some African nations that have even lower wages, but it is below what any European normally we consider living standard type approach. Even in Germany, where this is supposedly a success story, real wages for working class Germans have fallen substantially for 25 years, over the last 25 years. So this is a terrible strategy. And Germany's quote unquote success, of course, makes it harder for the other nations to export. The more Germany exports, the fewer exports others can make. So it's absolutely insane as a strategy, which is also why we call this Stability and Growth Pact and oxymoron created by regular morons.
We're talking modern monetary theory with Professor Stephanie Kelton, who coined the phrase deficit owl, and William Black, a professor of law and economics at UMKC. Both are professors of economics at UMKC and have been traveling the world evangelizing this new theory. We've got an email at centralstandard@kcur.org from Russell, who writes, quote, "I accept the idea that a federal budget can be used as a shock absorber, but that doesn't mean it must be kept at reasonable limits to be available for that role. I can use my credit card for an emergency, but it gets out of control. The payments will exceed my borrowing capacity and income. I don't want the United States to wind up like Greece. The problem is our trade deficit, lack of personal savings, and an economy dependent on consumer spending." What do you have to say about Russell's comments?
Well, I think this goes to Bill's point that this is the biggest hurdle that we as MMT and others, you know, who understand this sort of thing, deficit owl sorts, that we face, which is that this notion that the federal government is like a household is so ingrained in our minds.
Very pervasive.
It's very pervasive. And it seems to make sense, right? Because very few people, I think, stop and think, well, when I borrow and I use my credit card, I get a bill in the mail and I write a check. And then at the end of the day, something happens to that check and money comes out of my account. And things are paid off. But I have to transfer somebody else's money in order to pay my debts. When the federal government runs deficits and runs up a debt, it just replaces one form of IOU, a treasury bond, with another liability, which is a Federal Reserve note or a bank reserves or something. It's fundamentally different when you issue your own currency and you pay your debts with a currency that you issue, as opposed to being the user of a currency, which is what we all are.
Right. So the fundamental difference here, to put it in the simplest terms possible, layman's terms, if a personal household in effect issued its own currency, the William Black or the Stephen Kelton or the Javelani in whatever denomination it was, that would make that household or that individual like the federal government. But because we don't issue our own currency, we're not.
Right. I mean, the fear is, you know, everybody is so afraid that we're watching what's happening in Europe. And if we don't get our fiscal house in order, my God, we're next. You know, we in the U.S. are next. And I think that's completely wrong. Greece is like Georgia in the U.S., right? Ireland is like Idaho. They are users of the currency. They face the same kind of problems that states face in the U.S. when their economies turn down and it becomes difficult to get dollars to pay their obligations and run their programs and so forth. The United States government is fundamentally different, and people fail, I think, time and time again to understand. And, you know, something very important changed in this country in 1971, and that is the U.S. went off the gold standard once and for all, and it is a game changer. And it's almost as if nobody realized that it happened. The textbooks that were written pre-1971 look just like the textbooks that have been written after 1971. We act like we face the same constraints we faced when we had a currency that was tied to gold and other currencies, and it's completely different. We have a whole range of options available to us now that we don't recognize and we don't take full advantage of. And it's a tremendous waste. It's a waste of resources. We tolerate 25 million Americans who want full-time work and can't find it because we think we can't afford to provide jobs for people. We have $2.3 trillion infrastructure deficit. We don't fix our roads and bridges and levees because we think we don't have the money to do it.
Here's a thought experiment. The heads of the new conservative government in the United Kingdom have announced that they have run out of money. Now, the United Kingdom didn't join the euro, still has the pound, a sovereign currency. So here's the thought experiment. If Germany were to invade the United Kingdom tomorrow, would the United Kingdom surrender and say, I'm sorry, we ran out of money to pay for our defense? You know, it's ludicrous, right? Everybody knows it's ludicrous. There is objective evidence of how much of our real world, real resource capacity we have used up. How risky are we perceived in terms of our debts? How risky is hyperinflation in America? And that is the bond market for the United States bonds. Go and look at it. Go and look at what happened after we got downgraded. Rates actually went down because there is no risk for debts denominated in our own currency that we will lack the capacity to repay. Now, there are some crazy Republicans who want to repudiate our debts, but if they do that, it'll last 24 hours. It will cause an economic crisis, and they will, you know, come to their senses or they'll be removed from office.
Is the fundamental misunderstanding of economics and economic policies as they apply to real-world issues an impediment to your theory gaining traction here in the United States?
It is. And as Professor Kelton said, it's perfectly understandable. I mean, what we know is our household, and we spend our time trying to be responsible within our household and to teach our kids to be responsible when they set up their households. It's just a terrible metaphor for what the real monetary system is once you have a sovereign fiat currency. And, for example, there were other metaphors. Again, this one is not correct, but it points out that there are other metaphors. Why did we pick this one? Why don't we operate like corporations? Do corporations try to get rid of all their debt?
No.
No, corporations try for extreme leverage, right? Lots and lots and lots of debt, much higher debt percentages than many nations and such. And anybody who came and said to the corporation, you're being immoral, right? You're not being sound. You're not being principled. You got to get rid of all your debt. We'd all look at them like they were crazy. Okay, so why is it, again, that we pick the household as our metaphor. Again, most of us don't run corporations.
What's the reality on the ground over there in Europe with the European Union? Tell us about how people are feeling over there, from scholars all the way down to average everyday people. Because we hear about it in the news, but what's the reality on the ground?
It's far worse than here, and it's bad here. I mean, there were polls, of course, done on how many people wanted to repudiate the U.S. debt by not raising the debt ceiling. I mean, it wasn't phrased that way, but that's what it means, repudiate the federal debt. And two-thirds of Americans didn't want to raise the debt ceiling. They wanted to repudiate our debt. That's crazed. In Europe, this TINA, there is no alternative, has been so built in that there's a feeling of hopelessness and even more destructive. And we've seen this in Ireland and in Italy. A blame yourself as a victim approach that is completely debilitating. So the reason we were so well received is we said this is nonsense. There are alternatives, and there are vastly better alternatives.
Here's one for you. Daryl in Kansas City asks, why do we pay taxes then if the government can just make its own money?
Good question. Well, one of the reasons that we pay taxes, of course, is that it allows the government to take money out of our hands and limit how many resources we take control of. So in other words, it allows the government to have some control of some resources. So if the private sector had all the money, we could buy all the resources. Well, the government wants some resources too. It wants to provide certain things, you know, like education and roads and bridges and national security and things like that. So taxes really, and government spending as well, both sides of fiscal policy, you should think of it like a thermostat in the room, right? When the economy is running too hot, you turn down the temperature, right? Your economy's running too hot, you cut government spending, you raise taxes, you take some income away from the private sector so that you don't get inflationary pressure. When your room is too cold and you want to heat things up, you use the thermostat. You use fiscal policy in the same way, increase government spending, cut taxes. And so taxes are kind of a way to regulate aggregate demand. That's how it's best to think of taxes.
But to put that question together with the comment you made earlier about what if we issued the currency of bill? No one accepts a currency of bill because, you know, why should they? Governments make you pay taxes in their currency. That's why the currency has so much obvious value. So it's actually the listener has asked a fundamental question that shows exactly why things happen as they do.
And of course, Daryl, that tax revenue is also used to service interest on the debts that are issued in the capital markets. Is that another myth that's out there?
Yeah, actually, that is. There are some wonderful quotations from the Federal Reserve in which they make it absolutely apparent that they understand that it's really created electronically, that we don't actually have to go through these physical debt issuances. Indeed, there's a line from Greenspan, what do you mean we didn't hit the number we wanted to hit? You just have to hit the button harder.
Mark in Leawood, welcome to Central Standard.
Hi, I appreciate your guest's explanation of the inapplicability of household finance to the world. But I tell you, I get my copy of The Economist, and I look at those tables in the back, and I look at the huge, you know, national debt that we have, and more important, the debt service that comes out of our budget every year. Help me feel more comfortable about that, please.
Help Mark feel more comfortable about the U.S. pace of debt service remittance.
One thing is to look at World War II, when it was bigger. And the fundamental answer is growth, which we haven't been talking about much, but we have implicitly. We've shown how Europe, as part of its strategy, and its ultra – I mean, they're beyond debt hawks, right? Have actually thrust themselves back into recession and made their debt burden worse, right? You can look at the bond markets and what the bond markets – these are the people who are risking their own money and who are the alleged professionals. Now, you should have some caution given the crisis about that, but look at what they're pricing that U.S. risk as. So the ratios tell you next to nothing when you have a sovereign currency. Actually, they tell you something interesting if you look at it in conjunction with interest rates. Because look at Japan, which has a debt burden beyond that of Greece, and borrows money at virtually zero. Why? Because it has a sovereign currency. So we have an MMT leading theorist, Warren Mosler, who has a great line, and that is, because we fear becoming the next Greece, we're turning ourselves into
the next
Japan,
essentially. Our guests are Stephanie Kelton, an econ professor at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, and William Black, a professor of law and economics at UMKC as well. And both are regaling us on their school of thought, modern monetary theory. We're going to take a quick break. When we return, we hear our guests' thoughts on the new Jobs Act. Kansas City, what have you always wondered about how an economy works? What solutions have you dreamed up for our national budget that you'd like to run by our guest today? 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. You can also email us at centralstandard@kcur.org. And welcome back to Central Standard. I'm Jabalani LaFall. According to campaign literature, the purpose of the recently passed Jobs Act is to make people go back to work and put more money in the pockets of working Americans without adding a dime to the deficit. In the world of fiscal and monetary policy, though, things, as our guests will explain, are never that simple. Our guest today has said that the Jobs Act is something only a financial scavenger could love that would create a fraud-friendly and fraud-enhancing environment. That guest is William Black, a professor of law and economics at UMKC. He, along with Stephanie Kelton, an econ professor at UMKC, have been regaling us this hour on their school of thought, modern monetary theory. We're going to get into the Jobs Act, but first, we have an email in from Mark at centralstandard@kcur.org who asks, what happens when the dollar is no longer the reserve currency? Right now, the dollar is needed by all countries to buy oil. We print all the money we want because of this. Eventually, the world will choose another reserve currency from a more responsible country. The U.S. will then turn, Mark says, into Zimbabwe. What are the thoughts on Mark's comments here? People used to think that perhaps the euro would take over as the reserve currency for the world's trade and economic usage, but we're seeing that that's not going to happen. So talk about Mark's question. What happens if the dollar is no longer the reserve currency? Is that even possible?
Oh, it's certainly possible. China may become so economically dominant that its national sovereign currency will become a reserve currency at some point, or in fact, perhaps the reserve currency at some point. But other nations like the yen are not reserve currencies, and they can borrow for next to nothing. So, no, that's not what happens when you are not a reserve currency.
Back up and explain what a reserve currency is for our listeners who don't know.
Well, in this context, I think what the listener is getting at is what do other central banks choose to hold in their reserves? And frankly, that too is mostly a vestige of the gold standard. If they have their own sovereign currency and they freely float it, there's no particular need for significant reserves. So all of
our dollars are essentially taking the place of what used to back the currency in the amount of gold for other countries.
Yeah, but Adam Smith wrote to denounce a lot of this mercantilism nonsense, and to use his most famous work corresponded with our Declaration of Independence. So we've known this is nuts for centuries at this point. It's become completely nuts, as Professor Kelton explained, after we went off the gold standard. And it's time to really update the textbooks so that people don't come in with these kind of beliefs.
What about this other thought, Professor Kelton? Eventually, the world would choose another reserve currency from a more responsible country.
Well, it's kind of interesting. As Bill said, a lot of the countries that accumulate dollar reserves are countries that operate fixed exchange rate systems, which means these countries want to fix the value of their currency. They want to stabilize it. And in order to do that, they have to be able to intervene in the foreign exchange market by buying and selling foreign currencies. And that means, in this case, if they're fixing their currency to the U.S. dollar, they need lots of dollars to do that. So the U.S. becomes kind of the spender of last resort. Without running big trade deficits and importing goods from these other countries, they don't get the dollars that they need in order to run their exchange rate policies the way that they want to. So, you know, it may be perceived as irresponsible to have a big trade deficit or a big public sector deficit. But as I've been trying to explain, you've got to understand sort of a more nuanced argument.
We got an email in from Steve asking a couple of questions. Can we have financial economic growth without incurring debt? That's his first question. And do you ever see the possibility of a quote-unquote moneyless society in the future? That's the second question. The last question is Rome burning? So which one of these things do you want to address first? Got back from Italy.
Let me take the last one. The periphery has been left to twist slowly in the wind, to use the U.S. metaphor. Unemployment is in the 20% range.
In real terms.
In any terms, unemployment is 20% and above in many, if not all, of the nations of the periphery are headed that way. They're all headed back into more severe recessions. Youth unemployment in virtually all these nations is 50%. So if you have two kids, one of them is likely to be unemployed. In almost all, in fact, all the nations of the periphery now are tending to lose their college graduates. In other words, they emigrate as when they get their degree. So it is a catastrophic effect in the periphery. If people are old enough, when the Goldwater said that as far as he was concerned, you could take the East Coast and just cut it off and let it drift into the Atlantic Ocean, and the Democrats read an ad about that, that's what's being done metaphorically to the periphery by Germany. Just let it go into the Mediterranean.
Can we have economic growth, the first question, without incurring debt?
Some nations can, running a really large surplus. Nations overall, no. Again, this is called the fallacy of composition. It's just pure error of logic, not just even economics.
And in that case, the person who's running the debt is the foreign country. So you can't have growth without debt. It's just you can do it without running up your own debt, but somebody else has to deficit spend in order to generate the growth for you.
That goes back to the statement you made earlier about a lot of countries becoming net exporters. It's just not possible in a system of debits and credits.
Well, this is, you know, Lake Wobegon to the nth, that everyone's above average. You can't have everybody be a net exporter.
We're going to get into the Jobs Act in a moment, but first we're going to go to Leslie in Leawood. Leslie, welcome to Central Standard.
Good morning, Jabalani. It's a great conversation, and I want to try and spin this question in a way that isn't political, although it's going to sound inherently political. But we were talking about the federal deficits, and I wanted to ask the professors about how the states view the role that they have with their budgets, which, you know, we hear all the time, we have to balance. You know, we have crazy ideas on the Kansas side about getting rid of all the taxes, and not all, but I'm talking about the income taxes, and this is going to do great, you know, spurring of growth for jobs for Kansas. I haven't figured out how that math works, but and so I wanted to understand a little bit, since in your former analogy, Professor Kelton was saying, you know, Georgia is like Greece. They're not printing their own money, right? They're using the federal dollars, and how their situations, what they do, let's just take our own two states here, impact at the bigger picture what the federal deficit calculations are.
Thank you, Leslie. She does make that point. You say Georgia is like Greece, Ireland is like Idaho. So what are Missouri and Kansas like relative to our federal budget deficits here domestically?
Well, Idaho and Georgia are users of the currency. And as the caller is explaining, the user of the currency has to behave differently from the issuer of the currency or the federal government. So, you know, this I understand exactly what she's referring to in the case of Kansas. It's the same exact sorts of policies that Greece is pursuing. I'm going to cut my taxes. I'm going to attempt to stimulate growth by cutting. And this is, you know, it's like the carpenter who said, no matter how much I cut, it's still too short. It's not going to add up. It's not going to generate. And it's, as Bill explained earlier, the sort of race to Bangladesh. If every state in the country adopted the same strategy, there would be no winner.
So now we're striking gold in the conversation, so to speak. Is the perception of the federal deficit based on the fact that states and state budgets are users of the national currency and therefore operate more like households than the federal deficit does?
That's a good point. Yes, they are closer to households, and everybody knew that. Everybody knew across the ideological spectrum among economists that there was going to be a catastrophe in state and local financing. What people, I bet you 99% of your listeners have forgotten, is that the stimulus bill had a substantial revenue sharing component precisely to deal with that, in which we were going to take federal money and transfer it to the states, who could transfer it to the localities as well, to deal with this. Because otherwise, the states and localities act in a pro-cyclical fashion. That means they make the business cycle worse. When they should be spending more, they spend less. They fire people. They add to unemployment in a great recession. That's insane. Revenue sharing is a Republican idea, but the Republicans and the Blue Dog Democrats, the conservative Democrats, got together and killed the revenue sharing component. And unfortunately, and this was an early foreshadowing of things, President Obama didn't fight it, didn't protest it at all. As a result, nobody knows that this was a catastrophe that didn't have to happen, that the United States would be much better off if we had done the revenue sharing. And you can see they don't even try to reintroduce it.
You're listening to Central Standard on 89.3 FM. Call letters KCUR. We're streaming live on KCUR.org. I'm your host, Jabalani LaFall. Our guests are Stephanie Kelton, an econ professor at UMKC, and also William Black, a professor of law and economics, also at UMKC. We've been talking about state and federal deficits, international trade, economics, modern monetary theory, all the good stuff, everything except lions, tigers, and bears. Kansas City, what have you always wondered about how an economy works? What solutions have you dreamed up for pulling us out of the Great Recession that you would like to run by our guests? Give us a call at 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. Or shoot us an email at centralstandard@kcur.org.
One other analogy. The states that are doing relatively better in terms of the budget, it's not because they're virtuous. It's because they're a leading exporter of, and energy prices have surged, and some other commodity prices have surged, right? So Texas is pretending like, oh, you know, we're the leaders of the nation. You should emulate us. Well, yeah, we should all have tons of hydrochemicals, you know, easily recovered under our but we don't all have that much oil. So this has nothing to do with virtue. It has to do with net exporters.
Getting to the subject of political will and political applications to the economic theory, William Black, why are you so down on the new Jobs Act?
Well, because it will destroy jobs. Nothing destroys jobs and wealth more than the kind of elite frauds that we call accounting control frauds, which is simply when the person running an organization that seems to be legitimate, so we're typically talking about the CEO, is the crook and uses it as a weapon to defraud others. That's what drove our savings and loan crisis, the Enron-era crisis, and this crisis. And in this crisis, it directly cost 6 million Americans their jobs, plus America was adding to jobs at around 2, 3 million a year. So, you know, that stopped as well. So over 10 million Americans didn't have jobs, largely driven by fraud. And so what is our answer? Let's try to create the most fraud-friendly atmosphere we can imagine. And what's our logic? Our logic is we've got to be more fraud-friendly than the City of London.
And by that, you mean aspects of the contentious aspects of the Job Act in terms of repealing some of the aspects of the Sarbanes-Oxley laws, the accounting laws and accountability laws, and eliminating conflicts of interest, allowing analysts to tout stocks that also are serviced by investment banking clients at that same bank, eliminating some of those sort of line item provisions of the Jobs Act or what you're talking about.
Correct. Not of course, you're doing the short form, not eliminating the conflict, but eliminating the sanction for the conflict, allowing
because it happens
the conflict
anyway.
Of interest. Well, because actually, yes, investigations found that conflicts of interest were absolutely the norm and that conflicts mattered. And indeed, the defense was, but everybody knows our valuations are useless and are that we're whores. You know, I mean, it's an insane world. I quote people old enough to remember the movie War Games, where they lock in a game of trying to win global thermonuclear war, right? Where, of course, the computer finally figures out the only way to win is not to play this game. The only way to win a race to the bottom of regulation is to refuse to engage in that race.
What would you say to a critic of your criticism of the Jobs Act that says, isn't the intention of all these provisions in the Jobs Act to create more access to capital and eliminate some of the more costly compliance fees for companies looking to gain access to public markets? You mentioned the City of London. A lot of the complaints among companies wanting to list in the U.S. was that some of the compliance provisions were too onerous, some of the penalties too stiff, and they went over to go list on the AIM market in London and some of the foreign exchange markets and foreign bourses where they would face less hindrance.
Okay, so let's look historically. U.S. equities, in other words, stocks, traded at a substantial premium compared to stocks issued elsewhere in the world. Why? Because we had the best regulatory system in the world, and people trusted it more. If they trust it more, they're willing to pay more for the stock, and that means you raise more capital, which is the whole purpose of this, right? So that was worked really brilliantly until we decided to trash it by making it fraud-friendly under the logic, again, that otherwise City of London. Now, step back a second. The same people who use this quote-unquote logic of the race to the bottom are the ones who are absolutely indifferent when the manufacturing plants in Kansas close and they move their businesses to another country. But when it comes to finance, oh my God, if finance moved to the City of London, oh, well, that would be a crisis. So it's weird in that sense. If they want to move the frauds to London, I will send them off with a champagne toast.
We got Mike in Overland Park. We're discussing economic theory and regulation and fiscal policy here on Central Standard with Professor Stephanie Kelton and William Black, both professors of economics at UMKC, regaling us on their thoughts of modern monetary theory. Mike, welcome to Central Standard.
Thank you, and thank you for the show. It's great. So I looked up on a website not long ago, just out of sheer curiosity, the amount of debt we paid in 2011. And I was kind of surprised when I saw the number, because you typically hear the number of about $220 billion in annual debt that we pay, or excuse me, in interest on the annual federal debt. And what this government website showed, though, which was interesting, was all of the municipal and all the state, local, federal debts combined, and last year it was over $400 billion that we paid in interest payments alone, of course, which we received no tangible benefits for. No teacher salaries are paid, no hot meals for homeless, no infrastructure is repaired or built with that $400-plus billion. And so earlier, Stephanie, you had used the analogy of a thermostat for how the federal government's role in helping the economy. It's kind of the classic Keynesian model. So my question to you is, based on that level of interest that we pay, that we receive no tangible benefit for, what would your impression or what is your opinion of how well the government has served in that Keynesian role over the last 30 or 40 years?
The Keynesian role of thermostat adjustment.
Well,
how has the government served in that role?
I think it's safe to say that the government should and could have been doing far more to address the problems that we have with joblessness and losing teachers and infrastructure and all those kinds of things. I think, again, you know, when you put accounting into your economics, you understand that on the end of every one of those interest payments is the receiver of that interest payment. And so there are bondholders out there that are receiving interest. And to the extent that people do spend a portion of their interest income, well, then there is a benefit to the economy. I don't know. If we were to look at state and local governments, how much of the borrowing that was done to improve schools and roads and bridges. So I don't think that we can necessarily assume that there was no benefit to that borrowing and those interest payments.
And that's, of course, a whole different argument, a whole different show. What do you foresee happening, William Black, as a result of this Jobs Act? In summary.
We've made it much more fraud friendly. We're going to have a whole lot more fraud. And I got a doctorate in criminology, and my primary research is in elite white collar crime. So I've got job security for life.
But beyond that, what are the lasting effects on everybody else's economy?
It is an enormous job killer. Let's go back to the previous caller. What has caused by far the largest part of the deficit? If you don't like deficits, then crack down on fraud.
And that's the essential solution to that.
Yes, but I would say also in the caller, state and local governments don't run Keynesian policies.
What do they run?
They run Hayek. How do you build the bridge? How do you build the hospital? They don't do it for purposes of stimulus. So that's a non sequitur. And second, just to use his argument, then he really should support the revenue sharing concept, because the federal government can borrow at next to zero and the states are paying considerable interest rates because there is a risk with states that they might actually default. So revenue sharing would have been a great win-win. And if, again, I think his misplaced more generally, but even within his own terms, then he should be an exceptionally strong supporter of revenue sharing.
William Black is a professor of law and economics at UMKC. We also had Stephanie Kelton, who coined the phrase deficit owl and is also an economics professor at UMKC. We've been talking about their objections to the recent Jobs Act and how modern monetary theory seems to be gaining traction in some economist circles. You can find their work on neweconomicperspectives.org.
.org.
Thank you for coming to Central Standard, both.
Thank you.
And tune in tomorrow when we broadcast and digest a live event hosted by Harvest Public Media and NPR member station KBIA about food production myths and realities that are, in a word, hard to swallow for some. Our show is produced by Andreas Lindsay with help from Charlie Upchurch. Up to Date is next with a look at a new play at the KC Rep, The Whipping Man. I'm Jabalani LaFall. This is Central Standard. Enjoy your day.